Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 3rd, the year 2000, and in the fireside room tonight, Mavis Anderson starts her series, Cuba, Neither Heaven Nor Hell, Our Island Neighbor, Cuba in Transition. This is tape number ANMA 2000-1. So now let's join Mavis in the fireside room.
Sit and listen to that for an hour. I guess we're ready to begin. My name is Mavis Anderson, and I'm here for a week to spend with you all, and glad you're here. My husband, Phil, is here also doing some sessions on refugees and immigration. We've got kids who are scattered all over the U.S. right now, but all out of the nest, so we were here about 10 years ago with our four teenagers at that point, and this is a little different experience, being here just on our own. I've got a couple of jobs, actually, that relate to the topic we're going to talk about today. I work with the Center for Global Education at Augsburg College in Minneapolis, where I direct our travel seminar program. We take educational study trips to many parts of the world, Africa, Latin America, the Caribbean, Middle East, Southeast Asia. And you'll see some materials out here on the fireplace that you're free to take. I'm not going to pass things around, but please help yourself to anything that you'd like here. I live in Washington, D.C., and you might think that working at Augsburg College in Minneapolis is a long commute. And it is, but I do it by email and telephone and fax and whatever. So I telecommute half of the time with the Center for Global Education. The other half of the time I work with a group called the Latin America Working Group, which is a coalition of about 60 national religious denominations, human rights groups, development groups that work on impacting U.S. foreign policy toward Latin America. And we do education and advocacy and lobbying on policy issues surrounding Latin America. So that's my background. So Cuba. What comes to mind when you hear that word? What happens in your head or in your gut when you hear the word Cuba?
Bay of Pigs.
Bay of Pigs.
Castro.
Castro. Fidel Castro. I think I'm going to turn this off.
Thank you.
On these days, Elian.
Elian, yes. What else?
Miami.
Mm-hmm.
Communism.
Hemingway.
Right. It's where he wrote Old Man and the Sea and a number of his famous pieces. He's got a favorite bar there called El Floridita, and it's still open, and people go there and hang out just like Hemingway hung out, and his favorite drink was a daiquiri, and so they feature their Hemingway daiquiris. What else?
Robert Redford.
Right. You remember the movie? Frankly, I don't remember the name of it.
Havana.
Maybe it was Havana that Robert Redford was in. And it probably took place in the 40s, early 50s perhaps, and showed Havana as the kind of the playground of the Caribbean, casinos, money, fancy hotels.
Mm-hmm. I was stationed in Cuba in the Navy in the 50s.
Uh-huh.
In a very different place then.
Uh-huh.
Remember the Maine.
Remember the Maine. How many of you are familiar with the Maine? We'll talk a little bit about that. Yeah. Well, what about if I say Fidel Castro? What images come to mind? What happens in your head or in your gut when you hear the name Fidel?
Revolutionary.
Big man. In many ways, huh?
I get a picture of a guy in a green uniform smoking a cigar with a big beard.
I can't believe he's been around so long.
Yeah. He'll be 74 come August, and no signs of slowing down whatsoever.
A man the world has passed by.
Uh-huh. A man the world has passed by.
Long speeches.
Would you say when you hear Cuba or, well, let's do them separately. If you hear the word Cuba, do you have mostly positive images and feelings or negative ones?
I have negative feelings about foreign policy. Mm. I think we're screwing the country.
About U.S. foreign policy?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
How about Fidel? What kind of, is it, put a value judgment on your reactions to that word. Is it positive or negative?
Megalomania.
It's confusing for me because I can think of things that I know that he did that were really good, positive. Mm-hmm. And there are other things that I have thought were not humanitarian.
Mm-hmm.
So I never really, I've always been confused about, you know, what to think.
You know.
I've given it positive feelings because I think if other nations had done to the U.S. what we do to them, that we'd be outraged. And by trying to kill them, which we had the CIA do for a couple of years, and blame them for nuclear weapons when we were stockpiling them at the same time in the same place.
Cuban Missile Crisis, yeah.
So Guantanamo Bay had nuclear weapons, we now find out at the same time.
Well, one of the things that I've found out in working on Cuba, Phil, would you mind closing the door for me, please? Is that passions run very deep. No matter where you fall on the issue, if you're invested in issues surrounding Cuba, passions run deep, emotions run deep, and it's seldom a quiet conversation when you get some people in a room who may hold differing opinions about Cuba. People hold very strong opinions, and they hold them very, very, very firmly. So we're going to spend an hour talking a little bit about Cuba. And what I want to do is talk mostly about Cuba today. What are some of the challenges that Cuba is facing post-Soviet Union support? What are the possibilities? What are the ups? What are the downs? But I think in order to do that, we should set a little context. So I'm going to do a little bit of history. Cuba is an island that's just 90 miles from our shore, 90 miles from Miami. So it's a very close neighbor, and it's been pretty intricately woven throughout our history. And if you go back, and even back as far as Jefferson, you'll find references to Cuba. And the United States has carried historically a very strong interest in Cuba as a possible possession of the U.S., as a possible territory, state, whatever. There's been a lot of interest in Cuba on the part of the U.S. historically. So just a little background. On October 28, 1492, good old Christopher Columbus landed on the shores of Cuba. And Columbus kept a diary in his travels, and what he said about Cuba was, "This is the most beautiful land that my eyes have seen." But what he went on to say was, "Where there is such marvelous scenery, there must also be much profit that can be made." So right away you see Cuba and the other places that Columbus landed as a source of profit for the world from which he came. Columbus thought he had landed in India, Bombay actually, and so he called the natives that he found in Cuba Indians. They had tobacco. They were a friendly. There were three main Indian tribes in Cuba. They were friendly to the Spaniards. Tobacco was a very big thing with them. They had this leaf that they would roll up and smoke. It was the first exposure of Europe to tobacco. But the Spaniards wanted gold, not tobacco, at that point. So in 1512. Another Spaniard was commissioned, Velazquez, was commissioned to conquer Cuba for Spain. And over the next years, there was some bloody fights, and the Indians basically were exterminated. They either were brutally murdered, or they, for fear of living under the Spaniards, whole tribes committed suicide. So in about 20 years, the Indian population in Cuba was basically gone. And so then Cuba became a Spanish colony from 1510, 12, around in there, up through 1898. Cuba was a colony of Spain, and it went through more or less a traditional colonial history of once the Indians were exterminated, Cuba started importing, or the Spaniards started importing Africans from Africa to do the work on the plantations to mine the gold, the small amount of gold that they found, to work as slaves. And in fact, today Cuba has more than half of its population are Afro-Cubans. Cuba was of strategic importance, and you can kind of see that on the map. Actually, if I had a world map, you'd see it better, but it's kind of the key to the whole quote-unquote new world. So as Europe became more and more ensconced in the new world, Cuba was a stopping point. It was a key, it was strategic, and for us now, it has remained so throughout the Cold War. It was obviously a strategic issue between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. So it's held a very important piece of history, more than you would think it would because of its size. 1790 was a key date because that was the date, 1790-91, of Haitian independence. So Haiti and freeing of the slaves. Haiti became an independent country and was then black ruled. Well, with the loss of the sugar plantations and the slave labor in Haiti, Cuba was there to pick up the main producer of sugar, and also then the need for more and more slaves. So slavery became very tightly ensconced in Cuba and remained so for as long as sugar was a major world crop. Slavery was abolished in Cuba in 1880, and that was a few years after the bottom dropped out of the world sugar market. And at that point, the slavery was more vulnerable to being being abolished. Cuba's had a couple of wars for independence. One, the first war for independence, lasted from 1868 to 78, a 10-year unsuccessful struggle for freedom from Spain, and also for fighting against slavery. And this is where the name José Martí first comes into Cuban history. Have any of you heard of José Martí? Okay, he's kind of the Cuban Washington. He's seen as the father of Cuban independence. And when he first came onto the scene, he was 16 years old. He, in school, did some writing about the revolution, the fight for independence that was going on. He was arrested, imprisoned, sentenced to 15 years in prison. Eventually, a couple years later, he was freed and he was deported to Spain, where he then, as about an 18, 19-year-old, continued his studies. A very brilliant person, a poet, a writer, a fantastic orator. He spent most of his life outside of Cuba, but all of his life dedicated to the freedom of Cuba. He also lived in Mexico and eventually was exiled to the United States. So he spent a lot of his years living in New York. So this 10-year war went on, failed, was put down. Some of its leaders were killed, and Cuba remained a colony of Spain. This is also the time from 78 up through about 95 when the United States really became inserted into Cuban politics, history, economics. At the time that the United States gained its independence, 1776, Spain was supportive of that and allowed its colony, Cuba, to trade with the new nation of the United States. And so a strong trading relationship was established. U.S. also invested heavily in Cuba. The U.S. controlled the sugar trade. In fact, the U.S. was the only customer of Cuba's sugar during this period of time. And José Martí was writing out very strongly against this. He was supporting sovereignty for Cuba, non-dependence, which Cuba was becoming more and more dependent upon the U.S. economically. So from New York City, where José Martí was living, he was the spirit and the brains behind the Second War for Liberation in Cuba, which started in 1895. And as he saw himself as a person of integrity, and he felt that he should not just write and encourage others to struggle for independence, but he should take up arms and become a fighter also. So Martí went to Cuba. And in one of the very first skirmishes in this War of Independence, he was killed in 1895. But the war continued. The rebels gained more and more popularity. More people came to support them. And in fact, by 1898, the war was almost won. And at that point, the United States became inserted again very deeply into Cuban politics. And here's where we have the battleship Maine, 1898. The war was all but won between Cuba and Spain, but the United States, wanting to protect U.S. citizens living in Cuba and also the strategic importance of Cuba to the United States, sent the battleship Maine to Cuba to rescue U.S. people living there and to protect U.S. property. Well, the battleship blew up, and everyone on board, who, by the way, were mostly Africans at that point, African Americans, were killed. And there's a lot of mystery around this. Some people say that the United States blew the battleship up ourselves, to have an excuse to enter this war. The United States immediately blamed Spain for the blowing up of the Maine battleship and declared war against Spain. It didn't take long until the war came to an end, and this Cuban-Spanish war has in history been called the Spanish-American War, even though the U.S. was late in entering it and really was not the decisive force in causing Spain to give up Cuba. So the war was won. The U.S. flag replaced the Spanish flag flying over Cuba, and in fact where the peace agreement was signed was in Santiago de Cuba on the southern coast of Cuba, and the Cuban rebels, the Liberation Army, weren't even allowed into the city as the U.S. flag was raised above that city. So Cuba then entered a period of 3 years of a military protectorate of the U.S. This was not the independence of which Martí had dreamed, certainly. In 1901, a new constitution was written, but interestingly enough, it was written in the United States, brought to Cuba, presented to the Cuban Assembly, and it contained an element, an amendment to it called the Platt Amendment, which is a piece of history that sticks in the craw of Cubans to this very day. Because in that amendment, the U.S. had written that in perpetuity, the United States would have the ability to intervene at will in Cuban affairs to protect Cuban sovereignty, which I think is an interesting thing, that we could intervene to protect their sovereignty, and to keep stability within the Cuban government. The Platt Amendment also gave the United States right to naval bases on the Cuban island, and in fact, to this day, we hold Guantanamo Bay as a naval base on Cuban soil. The Cuban Assembly wasn't too happy about this constitution, and certainly not about the Platt Amendment, but with the threat that the military occupation would continue, they gave in, they passed the constitution, and that became the new Cuban Constitution of 1902. And at that point, Cuba stopped being a U.S. protectorate and started on its own independent path. Well, as the military withdrew from Cuba, U.S. business rushed in. We bought land, we bought sugar mills, we bought cigar factories, we bought railroads, we bought banks, we controlled mines, cattle ranches, tobacco plantations. The economy was eventually in about 70% of the economy was in U.S. hands. Investments in Cuba by the United States rose from about $50 million in 1895 to $1.5 billion in 1925 and went up from there. Cuba had a very unstable history at this point, that it was a revolving door of presidents who were elected, quote unquote, but there was a lot of corruption, a lot of fraud. They had a one-crop economy, and that was sugar. World War II sugar prices soared, and so Cuba became this, as the movie that we were talking about, Havana, showed, this center for gambling, prostitution, excess, consumerism, beautiful hotels, nightclubs, dancing, which is not bad, but it was all in an atmosphere of corruption and certainly not of equality for the people of Cuba. Cuban beaches were off limits to Cubans, the whole gamut of inequality. Well, sugar plays increasingly a part in Cuba's history, and again, the sugar prices dropped drastically in 1924 to about 3 cents a pound. And this just fueled revolutionary fever in Cuba. The economy was horrible. People were poor. People were wanting a change in their government. At that point, a dictator took power who bought the elections, a wealthy person bought the elections. He ruled for about 8-9 years. And again, the Cubans were just demanding changes in their government. Changes in, yes?
What was the name of that individual?
Machado.
Thank you.
Machado.
No.
So in 1933, there was a national strike. And again, just to show the desire of the Cuban people for a change. And at this point, another name that we associate with Cuba comes to the forefront, and that's Fulgencio Batista, who was the dictator at the time that Castro took power. Well, he at first controlled the country as an army. He was a sergeant, but then he moved up to general for several years, quite a few years, from 33 until actually 52. And again, it was a revolving door of one president and another who were elected by fraudulent means, with Batista as the power behind all of them. A new political party started to gain strength. It was called the Orthodox Party. And in 1952, there were going to be elections, and it looked like they were going to win. This would have foiled Batista's plans for himself and his cronies. So instead of allowing elections, he took power in a coup d'etat, a military coup d'etat, and declared himself president, and was the dictator of Cuba for 7 years. It was a time, again, of corruption, of repression, of prostitution, of inequality, of police brutality. Difficult time. Life was hard for the Cuban people. So, at this point, in 52, we enter Fidel Castro. He was a newly graduated law student, just had finished law school. He was a member of the Orthodox Party, who probably would have taken power had Batista not carried out a coup. He was a former student at a Jesuit high school. Fidel was trained by the Jesuits as a high school student. He was kind of an all-and-out rebel. And sort of the Cubans called him and his cronies kind of the crazies. So Fidel gathered about 125 of these crazies around himself, and on July 26, 1953, he and these 125 not well-trained and certainly not well-armed young men attacked what's called the Moncada Garrison in Santiago de Cuba, again on the southern coast of Cuba. They lost terribly. All but a few of them were killed. Those who escaped went to the mountains where they were hunted down, captured, tried, put in prison. Many of those who were put in prison were tortured to death in prison. Fidel was sentenced to 18 years of prison on the Isle of Pine, which is the small island off the southwestern part of Cuba, this little place here. It was a prison, and Fidel and a few of the others who survived this attack on Moncada were imprisoned. There was a lot of organizing to get them out, and finally, several years later in 1955, an amnesty was declared. Fidel and his cronies were released. And they went into exile in Mexico and again began planning to overthrow Batista. This is where Fidel met Ernesto Che Guevara, the Argentinian physician who became involved with the Cuban liberation struggle. So they trained for about a year in Mexico, and they got a hold of a yacht, a pleasure yacht called the Granma. And 82 people. Now, this yacht is probably supposed to hold a dozen folks or so. This is not a huge yacht. In fact, it is on display right now in Cuba. They have preserved it, and it's kept in a sort of a hermetically sealed environment so that it doesn't deteriorate. And it's a pleasure yacht. Well, 82 guerrilla fighters crowded onto this pleasure yacht at the Granma and headed for Cuba to start again their warfare against Batista. They encountered a hurricane, they got delayed, they landed where they didn't want to land. Things didn't go well, and obviously their mission on that day was not successful. On December 2nd, 1956, they landed in Cuba, and again, of these 82, only a few, a handful, survived the first battles that they fought. So the five or six, literally, that's all that was left, five or six people who were left went to the Sierra Maestra Mountains and again recouped and started drawing attention and with guerrilla tactics made their presence known. Their army grew and it became such an incredible movement within Cuba that not only were there skirmishes of the guerrillas from the mountains, but there was a lot of organizing and activity in the cities. And finally, it became so hot for Batista that on July 1st, 1959, he fled the country. And Fidel Castro and his 26th of July movement, they were called, took power in Cuba. So that's the history before Fidel took power. But what was the Cuba like that they found in their hands on January 1st, 1959? It was a country that had about 23% adult illiteracy. Some estimates go up as 43%, but I would guess somewhere in the 20s. 25% of the male population was unemployed. A half million children had no school to go to. They were two-thirds, in fact, of primary age children had no primary schools to attend. Housing was deplorable for 5 out of the 6 million Cubans at that time. The economy was a plantation system with primitive labor and primitive agricultural methods. Sugar was the greatest wealth of the country, and that was controlled by the United States interests, and we were their only customer. Banks were controlled by the U.S. Almost everything that you can think of was still in the hands of the U.S. Coffee, fruit, milk, cattle, tobacco, mines, the most fertile lands, hotels, railroads, casinos, the telephone company, baseball even was controlled by the U.S. So that was the Cuba that Fidel took power in. And just in summary, it was a country of corruption and of economic dependence. So what did he do? One of the first things he did was declare an agrarian reform, where he expropriated large farms, gave the land to the people who were tilling it, nationalized big plantations. He limited the size of farms. He instituted I'm saying he because it basically was at Fidel's bidding, instituted a free educational program that was launched by a massive literacy campaign in 1961, where hundreds and hundreds of young urban Cuban children from probably age, I'm not sure, 11 up through the teenage years, were sent into the far reaches of the country to all the rural areas where there was most illiteracy, and they worked, lived, breathed, slept, ate with the families where they were acting as teachers. And in fact, on one of my visits to Cuba, I met one of the gentlemen who was they were called brigadistas. He was part of the literacy campaign. He was about 13 years old. He now is working as a bus driver for a Baptist church in Managua, and in Managua, in Havana. And he told stories about the campaign and just extremely proud. That's one of the things that has been achieved in the Cuban Revolution, is a fantastic sense of nationalism. They dealt with housing, reduced rents, built new housing. They expropriated houses from people who had two or three or four houses. They outlawed racial discrimination, outlawed prostitution. And at that point, it was estimated that there were 15 to 20,000 prostitutes in Havana alone. They declared that no beaches would be private. They were for all Cubans. No clubs would be private. They were for all Cubans. They tried to equalize the society in Cuba. Now, you may imagine that that didn't sit too well with the owners of the property, some of the wealthy Cubans and a lot of U.S. people. And it began the path of our government's conflicts. In 1961, we broke off diplomatic relations with Cuba, and we banned travel to Cuba. That was early 61. In April 61, the partial embargo was expanded to be a total trade embargo. Also in April 61 was the Bay of Pigs invasion, where some Cuban exiles from the United States, from Miami, were trained by the CIA and assisted by U.S. government to land on Cuban shore to try to overthrow Fidel. It failed miserably. And about 1,000 of those Cuban exiles were taken prison in Cuba. And 2 years later, they were traded to the United States for food and medicine, which Cuba at that point could not get. So they traded their prisoners for food and medicine for their population. There's a lot to tell, and I'm going to skip through some of this because I do want to spend most of the time, like I said, on what's happening today and then on your issues that interest you. The Cuban Missile Crisis was a big issue. That was in 1962 also, where we discovered in the United States that there was a buildup of Soviet missiles on Cuban soil, and literally the world was on the brink of nuclear war. It was avoided, and the Russian missiles were removed, and the United States agreed to remove missiles that we had in Turkey that were focused on Soviet Union. Some legislation has been passed that has increasingly clamped down on Cuba in terms of the embargo that we have against them. In 1992, we passed the Cuban Democracy Act, which prohibited U.S. companies with subsidiaries in other parts of the world from trading with Cuba. Previously to that, the subsidiaries could trade. It was just no trade could come from the U.S., but it was expanded in 92. And then in 96, we passed the Helms-Burton Law, which threatens sanctions against any other country that trades with Cuba. It has some provisions such as if a foreign ship, say a European ship or a Canadian ship, lands on Cuban soil, it's 180 days before that ship will be allowed to land on U.S. soil, which is a big incentive for other countries not to trade with Cuba because it sanctions their possibility of trading with the United States. The embargo continues today. There have been some attempts to loosen it, and actually I'm going to, on Thursday, do a whole session just on legislation and what some of the possibilities are for the future. So, one of the things that's really important to look at and leads into where Cuba is today is Cuba's decision to ally itself with the Soviet Union, the former Soviet Union. And there were some reasons why this happened. It was a gamble, I think, on Cuba's part to choose to ally itself so closely with the Eastern Bloc. And for many years, that gamble paid off for them. One of the incidents that pushed them that way in the very beginning is I said that the United States was the purchaser of all of Cuba's sugar. Well, one year, 1960, we decided to limit the amount that we bought from Cuba, and the next year, 61, we eliminated totally all of our purchases of Cuban sugar. So Cuba had no customers for its sugar crop, which was the basis for its economy. So the Soviet Union came to Cuba and offered to buy their whole sugar crop at about twice the going market rate. They provided Cuba with oil, which it needed for its industry. Cuba had really mechanized its agricultural industry from being very primitive to a highly technological industry. It needed petroleum for that. That was one step in bringing Cuba closer to the Soviet Union. Cuba doesn't have any oil resources of its own, but it had some refineries, and the United States would ship oil to Cuba, and Cuba would refine the crude oil in their own refineries. When we stopped selling oil to them, the Soviet Union sold them oil, but the refineries in Cuba were in U.S. hands, and the refineries refused to refine Soviet oil. So Cuba nationalized the refineries, which further irritated the United States. So there were just a series of things like that that pushed them toward the Soviet camp and pushed the U.S. Farther into the opponent's camp. The challenge now, and you all know that the Soviet Union dissolved, fell apart, is gone, and the Eastern Bloc in 1989 and 1990. And for Cuba, this was a disaster of just unparalleled dimensions. 85% of their markets were Soviet markets. So literally overnight, they lost 85% of their markets. There were no places to ship their goods. They lost all the subsidies, they lost petroleum that the Soviet Union was giving them. It was a time of disaster. In fact, people were so desperate. The most difficult years were probably 91 to 93. People were so desperate in Cuba that I didn't visit there at that time, but I've talked to people who have, that you could just see it in their eyes. They spent their days trying to survive, to feed their families, to get enough income to provide clothing and shelter for their families. And literally, people didn't starve. It wasn't to that point. But people did lose weight. Their diets became very, very restricted. It was just a very, very difficult time for them. Somehow they have survived that. And I think the reason they've done that is that they took some very risky and, for them, difficult decisions on their economy. It's a socialist state. It's a controlled economy. And that's what they have declared themselves to be and what they say they want to be. And it became so clear at this time in history that they were going to have to do something different because they weren't going to survive if they didn't open up their market somewhat. Employment had become a problem. Up until that point, there was no unemployment in Cuba. Everyone had a job. But with the collapse of the Soviet Union, factories were closed, jobs disappeared, cutbacks happened. There were a lot of people who were unemployed. And at that point, the only employer in Cuba was the state. It's a socialist economy where everyone worked for the state. And the demand from the Cuban people to open up employment and self-employment became so clearly the route to go that that's one of the things that happened. In fact, they made probably three major economic moves. One of them was to allow for self-employment. They legalized self-employment. Secondly, they changed all of their state farms. Agriculture had been totally in the hands of the state. They changed their state farms into agricultural co-ops. They gave land to co-ops for production even of sugar. This was a major step for them because their agricultural program was kind of the apple of Fidel's eye. It was his pride and joy, and it became clear that as a state-run entity, they wouldn't survive. They didn't have the petroleum for the highly mechanized farming. They were going to have to go back to much more labor-intensive farming, so they converted their state farms into co-ops. They did not give title to the peasants who were farming the land, but they did grant them right in perpetuity to farm the land and to profit from it. And the third thing they did was that they opened up their entire economy to foreign investment, which prior to that time had not been possible. So Cuba now has a lot of what they call joint ventures, which are held jointly by the Cuban state and foreign investment companies. The challenge for them now, as they modify their socialism, is how to maintain the radical nationalism that had developed in their country, and how to preserve the greatest amount of social equity, which was one of the great achievements of the revolution. Their free education for all Cubans up through university, free health care for all Cubans. The ratio of doctors to patients in Cuba is about one doctor for every 400 people. Doctors live right in the communities with their patients. Every neighborhood has its own family doctor. They want to preserve their social security system, and they want to care for the children and the elderly. Those are the priorities of their revolution. But they're going to have to find a way to do that within a global economy that has more and more impact on them. There's some trade-offs on these kinds of measures. They legalized the dollar as part of their economy so that now people can pay in dollars or in pesos in Cuba. And though that has helped tremendously in having people have access to materials and goods and food that they hadn't had before, it's also done away with the equality that had been in Cuban society, because people who have more access to dollars become better off than those people who don't have access to dollars. Those people who have relatives living in the United States get family remittances sent to them. They've got dollars in their pocket. Those people who find jobs in the tourist industry, where dollars are the only medium of exchange, they get paid in dollars. They've got dollars in their pockets. So the issue of equality has become an issue for Cubans again, because there are some now who have more access than others. I think what I'm going to do is, rather than go through all of these economic changes, I'm going to just let you tell me what you're interested in hearing about. What are the things about Cuba that you'd like to know, just in terms of economy, the revolution, whatever? Let's just open it up to questions. Yes?
What has been the rationale that you heard expressed from those who support the sanctions and the other anti-Cuban activities the U.S. government has been using?
The people who support the sanctions in the U.S. these days, according to recent polls, is shrinking quite rapidly. There was a poll done by Gallup, I think in January or February, and it showed that 72% of the American public want to normalize relations with Cuba and end the embargo. So numbers are shrinking in terms of those who defend the embargo. In our Congress, there are a few very powerful people. Two of them are the Cuban-American representatives from Florida. Another is a Cuban-American representative from New Jersey. And in cooperation with the leadership in the House and Senate, they've been successful in blocking any kind of initiative to loosen the embargo. That's changing, and it's going to change. The door is open just a crack. But in my opinion, it's not going to close again. As far as rationale for maintaining the embargo, what the Cuban Americans say is that this is a repressive country that tortures people, that doesn't allow free speech, that puts dissidents in jail, that takes all the food and medicine for itself as the government rather than giving it to its people. granted, Cuba has some issues in terms of individual human rights. It's a socialist country, and freedom of speech is not one of the things that their citizens enjoy. There are a lot of other things that they do enjoy, but there are some issues for Cuba to grapple with. Those are the things that the embargo promoters pull out.
Don't a lot of the politicians in Washington, D.C. have a hang-up about making any change while Castro's still in charge? I mean, it seems like they're... He's an impediment no matter what else you might argue.
Right. And in the early 90s, when it appeared that Cuba was going to self-destruct, when it had lost all of its support from the Soviet Union, frankly, the community in Miami was preparing to go back. I mean, they thought Castro was done. They were going to go back and take control. And by some amazing effort and commitment on the part of the Cuban people, they survived. Castro is a problem. He has thumbed his nose at the U.S. government for 40 years now. He has survived, what, five presidents? He's a robust gentleman. He's going to be 74 in August, and he's showing no signs of slowing down at all. So I think waiting around for Cuba to be post-Castro is probably, it's not going to happen for a while. In fact, when delegations go to Cuba and they meet with Fidel, he usually invites, I mean, he meets with Congress people, and, you know, he doesn't meet with just the student groups that I bring there. But when he meets with groups, he invites them to his home for dinner or to party headquarters, I'm not sure which. But dinner starts at about 11 at night, and at 4 or 4:30 in the morning, Fidel is still going strong. And the people that he's talking to, you know, are sinking in their chairs. This is a man of strong constitution. He's not showing any signs either of losing his you know, intelligence, his faculties. He's clear and able, and he certainly appears healthy. So I think that kind of waiting for Fidel to die is losing sway, though written into our law are provisions that say unless Cuba does this and this and this, the embargo will be in place.
It does seem interesting now that we've arrived at a point where Castro's still there, but the Cuban Americans have lost a lot of credibility, you know, at least in the general public. Mm-hmm. I don't know what Congress thinks. Mm-hmm.
No, they're also.
So it's certainly a change in environment.
Yeah, there has definitely been a shift. And I think several things have come together to cause that. One is Elian. Clearly, this little six-year-old boy brought Cuba to our consciousness in no way that has happened in the last 40 years. In a very human way, so that I think people's hearts were touched by this sad tragedy of Elian. So that's one thing. I think the farm crisis is another thing that has really aided in making us look at this embargo again. Farmers in the Midwest need markets. Cuba is a market for rice, a market for wheat, a market for all kinds of things. And estimates are that very quickly, markets in Cuba on food and medicine alone could amount to $1 billion, with it going up from there. So there's a push by farmers to open up markets, not only to Cuba, but also to Iran, Libya, North Korea, Sudan, the countries that are on the so-called terrorist list. So that's a second thing. Third thing, I think, is the openings that we have made with Communist China. How do you rationalize being willing to trade with China and kind of giving away the store to them in terms of normalizing our trading relationships with them when they're, you know, millions of people way far away, and here we've got this little tiny island that we can't deal with? Vietnam. 54,000 U.S. citizens died in Vietnam, plus, you know, 3 million Vietnamese. We trade with Vietnam. We have just recently started opening up trading possibilities with North Korea. Cuba is the only place left, and people are starting to see the absurdity of that, not just the American public, but legislators as well. People who for years have been embargo supporters have changed their minds. So I think the light has been turned on and the door is starting to open. Yes.
When all this stuff was going on with Elion, I was listening to what the Q&A trial were saying. And I wonder if a lot of them were wealthy Cubans who lived there and had lots of property and money and had to leave because it was taken away and want to go back and have the same
Absolutely. The Cubans who left early on clearly were those who had the power and had the economic resources that were taken away from them, so they left. And they have, for 40 years, carried the dream of going back and, you know, getting their farm back, getting their, you know, recreating the Cuba that they left. And that's not going to happen. That's not going to happen. Cuba is a very educated population now. Their literacy rate stays at around 3 to 4%. They're on a par with developed nations. Their life expectancy is on a par with developed nations. Their infant mortality rate is better than that of Washington, D.C. There have been some incredible gains for the majority of people in Cuba. The minority who held the power are the ones that left and won it back.
But are they the boat people? Who are all these recent boat people? They aren't the rich, are they?
No, no. Cuba's not an easy place to live in right now. It's a poor country. Everybody has enough. The subsidies maintain enough for everyone, but nobody is living a luxurious life. And there's frustration also with some of the individual human right deficiencies in Cuba. People want more power in making decisions. They want a more open debate in their society. There are pressures in Cuba pushing it that way, and that's why a lot of these people leave. They also hear from their relatives in Miami about, you know, the wealth that they have been able to gain in the United States, and people want more than what they have. So yes, there's not, I'm not going to say that there's no dissatisfaction in Cuba, because that's not true, but interestingly enough, almost to a person, there are some 130 dissident groups in Cuba, and almost to a person, the dissidents, the opposition to Fidel Castro say, end the U.S. embargo. There's no reason for this embargo. It causes suffering for our people. And even though we oppose this government, we also oppose the U.S. embargo. Rafael.
Let me mention that at this time, there's a problem also between Haiti and Dominican Republic. They're running around from one country to the other. And in Puerto Rico, they're taking the same thing. The boats are coming from Dominican Republic, coming to Puerto Rico. There's every month a few people die trying to get to Puerto Rico from Dominican Republic. It's not a matter of, it's the poverty, the dream of going somewhere else where they're gonna be better. Mm-hmm. They do it from Miami, Cuba. It's not because of Castro, it's economy. The same thing happened from Dominican Republic mm-hmm. to Puerto Rico, and it's happening somewhere in the other islands, farther down from Granada or Tortola to the other bigger island. You know, they don't have the money to go by plane or it's illegal, but they do it illegally. Mm-hmm. It's happening right now.
It's not just Cuba, right? Yes.
What do you think the effect would be on the human rights deficiencies of the embargo were lifted?
Very interesting question. What would be the effect on the human rights situation in Cuba if the embargo were lifted? Many people who support ending the embargo say that that's the best way to effect changes in Cuba, is to open up contact between the U.S. people and the Cuban people freely exchanging travel, goods, information, whatever. And that will push the Cuban government to give more freedom to its people as they have more and more contact with a free people. That's one of the strongest arguments that you hear in the legislature when it's debated in the U.S. Congress, is that more people-to-people contacts, more contact between our governments is going to push Cuba in the direction of opening up its society. I don't know if that's true or not, but that's certainly one of the arguments for getting rid of the embargo.
Do you have a feeling about this little boy that has been in the news so much?
Sure. Yeah. We, you know, as the Latin America Working Group, we didn't take any public position on Elian because we really work on legislation. But I did have the opportunity to meet him the day before he went back to Cuba. In my opinion, he should have gone back, you know, a long, long time ago. He belonged with his father and he belonged with his people. And his father should have had the right to take him back when he wanted him back. He looks in person just like he does on TV. He's a six-year-old boy. We had a meeting with his father and Elian and his stepmother and little half-brother, plus his school friends and their mothers and a nurse. And the father, Juan Miguel, talked and expressed thanks specifically to the Methodist Church, who had been very instrumental in helping him raise money to pay legal defense funds and helping him find a place to live with his family when he was here. So he came to the Methodist building where my office is located to give thanks for the help given him. And he was very gracious and he's a very gentle, soft-spoken, just as he appears on TV. He's a very soft-spoken, gentle man. He said, I want to go back home to Cuba. And Elian, as most six-year-olds, was sitting there playing with his hands and making eyes at people and wiggling, just like a normal six-year-old boy. And the next day after I met him, they went home. And I think that was the best thing to happen.
Partially answer to a question I've often asked, who was paying for all this for Elian and his father? And you partially did it, but...
Well, the Methodist...
The minister has not told us.
No, the Methodist Church was not paying for it, but they did set up a fund to receive contributions. Contributions have come from many places, and I don't know, you know, all of the sources where money has been gotten. The National Council of Churches helped. Again, I don't think it was the church is giving their own money, but I think helping to raise money from their constituents, from the American people, from I don't know where else. I would guess that some of the foundations, some of the more progressive foundations in the U.S. probably gave money. I don't know. I don't have that information either.
Didn't come from taxpayer money.
No, absolutely not.
No. How difficult is
though taxpayers' money obviously was used in all of the legal gyrations that we went through for 5 months. That did cost taxpayers money, but taxpayers money didn't go to Elian's legal defense.
What's the population of Cuba?
11.5 million.
How difficult is it for Americans to travel in Cuba?
Well, come tomorrow, Wednesday, I'm going to do a whole session on that. There are categories. You still have to get licenses from the U.S. Department of the Treasury Office for Foreign Assets Control. There are a couple of categories of people that can travel without license. One is U.S. government officials on official business. One is journalists, full-time journalists. And Cuban Americans have the right to travel back to their homeland once a year on family business. Anybody other than that is required to get a license.
There's a woman in my congregation who has most of her family still in Cuba, and she seems to be impervious to regulation. She just goes and comes back, and I think, wow, but she doesn't talk about it very much.
Sure. Well, when we travel, I travel there with study groups, and we travel, though you can take a direct flight now, but they're very, very booked. We travel through a third country. We go through Cancun, Mexico, or we go through somewhere else in the Caribbean, or you can go through Canada, but you travel through a third country to get there. But we do it also with license, so we could fly directly. We could get the flights. And that's probably how she does it, too. She flies through a third country. Yes?
If the embargo were lifted and we start shipping things down there, if cash was still in power, he pretty much can. When you ship all the stuff to him, is he still have control over it all in his government?
Yep. We have just, we're at the point right now of closing in on passing some legislation to allow for the sale of food and medicine to the Cuban government, which then distributes it to its population, or to private churches or whatever. That has not been passed. Hopefully it will. May not pass this session. I think it will next session. But yes, because it's a socialist state, the state would control the distribution of the goods. That's true. Yes.
Something that frustrates me sometimes is, it's like, okay, so you have people arguing against lifting the embargo because they really want Castro to be gone or things to change. And, you know, say, well, how do you know it's going to work to lift the embargo? But what we're doing now isn't doing anything.
Right, right. You know, 40 years
so why
of this.
Keep doing it?
Right. That's another one of the arguments that used. This policy has done nothing to change the government in Cuba. Let's try something different.
What's the story on Castro's daughter?
Well, she, I guess, lives in Miami. She is anti-Castro. I don't know the whole history of that. So, frankly, I don't know. Yeah.
Are there any sort of churches that are legal in Cuba?
Any what?
Churches that are legal?
Oh, yeah. Oh, churches are full to overflowing. I've worshipped in a number of churches in Cuba, both the Catholic Church, the Protestant churches. There are Baptists, Presbyterians, Methodists. There's a small Lutheran community. Churches are freely conducting worship services, freely talking about their faith, going door to door, evangelizing, dialoguing with the government. In fact, two of the elected deputies to their National Assembly are pastors, not members of the Communist Party. There's a Baptist pastor and I think a Presbyterian pastor who were elected as legislators. So there have been definitely some coming meeting of minds between Fidel and religion in the country, and it's moving in the right direction. Yes.
But how, if there are legislation election there, isn't supposed to be a dictatorship?
Isn't that interesting? There are elections. There are elections. It's a one-party state, clearly. There is one party. It's the Communist Party. But there are elections. And people can be proposed for office, be elected to office, who are not members of the Communist Party, who are anti-Communist Party, whatever. There are local elections in each neighborhood. Each neighborhood gathers in open assembly, proposes candidates to their municipal body. They're elected by free, direct, and secret vote. Then from the municipal bodies, the municipal parliament, there are regional parliaments, and from the regional parliament to the national.
But do they override Fidel and vote?
Fidel can only be voted for in his own district. So people, he's never on the ballot other than in Santiago de Cuba, which is his home district. The National Assembly of the People's Power, which is their Congress, chooses a Council of State, which is where most of the power is held. And Fidel is elected by the Council of State as their head. So he clearly has the power. Our time is up. I thank you for coming. Please take a look at some of this.